Welcome to the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of January the 27th, 2020. Current Federal Tax Developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and your State Society of CPAs. This week we're going to look at a few developments that took place as we are entering into the end of the first month of this year. It seems interesting how it all goes away that quickly. We'll talk about a court case where we got to the question with Microsoft about whether or not their advice they received from a accounting firm was considered to be protected privileged advice. We'll also talk about a case this week that looks at whether or not the IRS has to carry the burden to show every single transaction that a taxpayer might have engaged in that may have involved kickbacks or other illegal payments, whether the IRS has to show each one or whether they can actually just show a sample and work from that. We'll talk about a relief that was issued this week by the IRS dealing with notices for required minimum distributions for individuals who turned 70 and a half in 2020. We'll talk about that because those notices are due by the end of this week. So the IRS had to work something there. And we'll also discuss some information we got from the IRS this week reported by Tax Notes Federal, from a District of Columbia Bar Conference, where we find out some information about a question we've been worried about for a while, where the IRS now claims, well, we're not going to tell you the answer, but we're going to tell you that the answer is going to be out here real soon. Okay, with that, let's go ahead and get ourselves started. Now, a couple things coming up. Again, it is CPE time again, and we have our standard little routine going on for what's going on. Still CPE time left this year, I should say, that you could take it. We do have a couple of continuing education rebroadcasts that are coming up here with CalCPA. So those CalCPA broadcasts, if you go to their site, you can register there for their continuing education courses they offer. Also, you can register through your state society if your state society is participating. If you do your state society, you most likely can qualify for a discounted rate. If you go just as CalCPA as a non-member, you obviously will pay a non-member rate. But we're going to, on January the 27th, we are going to have the course on assisting the survivors of the decedent's estate. So that's relatively quick, unless you're listening in the weekend. We're going to run that on Monday. It'll be running at both 6 a.m. Pacific time and 8 a.m. So if it's before that time, you can still sign up. A little bit later, coming up in February and February 5th, there's going to be a single rebroadcast. There won't be two staggered start times. It'll begin at 8 a.m. Pacific, and it'll be the course I gave on protecting tax information, cybersecurity for tax professional. An interesting discussion, four-hour discussion with CPAs. We talked about some of the practical steps you can take to protect your data and looking at hopefully some research to tell us what's the biggest bang for the buck things you can do to protect client information, as opposed to just, you know, having a course. I've sat through these sites before where we have a course to tell you all these exposures and all these horrible things, and you sit down, you add up the cost to try to protect every one of them, and suddenly it's like I've got to spend $200,000. I don't have $200,000, so I do nothing. We're trying to give you a course that gives you much more direct, these are the big things that will protect against the most likely incursions. So assuming you don't have an unlimited budget and unlimited time, what can you do? That again will be coming up on February the 5th at 8 a.m. Pacific. Well, let's talk at our first issue this week, and this is a Chief Counsel Advice 2020-03-004 issued on January the 17th. And the issue here revolves around Internal Revenue Code Section 165. 165 generally denies a deduction to individuals for payments that represent illegal payments to government officials or other illegal types of bribes, kickbacks, etc. But the IRS has the burden here to show that. You know, if the taxpayer has shown they paid an expense and there's a reasonable business connection, the IRS has the burden to show that that payment would be thrown out under this rule. It is a part of the burden. In this case, we had little question the taxpayer had been involved in programs that at least, well, they eventually plead guilty to criminal charges related to some of these. So let's say it's fairly safe to say that it appears they were involved in illegal kickbacks and bribes for government employees. The way it was phrased, basically what they did was they involved in manufacture, promotion, sale of certain products. They needed something from the government. Now, the way this is worded, it's not real clear what exactly they were doing, but it does not appear the government was buying the thing. but it could have been the case of needing some government approval to put on the market, getting the government to do certain things, any event. So the taxpayer had essentially had their managers take these officials out to nice, lavish dinners. And they also got them speaking fees for speaking, or it turns out in some cases, even if they didn't speak, they still got paid. You didn't have to actually speak to get a speaking fee. But they made it very clear to these people they were working with that if they didn't do what the company wanted them to do, the speaking fees and the dinners would cease. So play with us and you'll keep getting this stuff. Don't play with us and we're going to cut you off from this stuff. Essentially, yeah, it doesn't sound good, shall we say. So that's at least how the thing is worded. So they wanted these actions, as I said, for dinners or the speaking engagements, even if they didn't speak. I'd find that interesting. It'd be kind of nice to be paid for not showing up. But, you know, hey, I usually have to show up, turns out. Kaplan wants me at a location before they'll pay me for it. Amazing how that works. They did have a guilty plea related to the events, and they entered into a civil settlement regarding some of these events. Now, the case in question now becomes the IRS is examining them. Now, remember, there may be tens of thousands of dinners and speaking engagements and various things, depending upon how many of these are going on. So there are a ton of these engagements. The burden is on the IRS to show that these were impermissible. What the IRS did on exam was they took a look at a sample, a reasonable sample, of the total transactions. And based on that sample, they came up with a percentage of the meals that were disallowed, percentage of the speaking engagements that they said should be disallowed, that they did not represent deductible expenses. The question being raised now on exam, and I assume the taxpayer is pushing back on this, was no, you have to go through every single invoice and document that specific instant of what we did that was wrong for that specific invoice. And if you can't do that, then we get a claim to deduction, so the only ones you can disallow are the ones you looked at. Well, the chief counsel advice decides that, in fact, that's not the requirement. Their position is that, essentially, the IRS meets its burden using the sample. That carries the burden to show that more, that there is basically by a preponderance of the evidence, clear and convincing evidence is the way in this case, but that presents clear and convincing evidence that there has been this situation done. They've met their burden. Now the burden's on the taxpayer to show that, in fact, the sample was unrepresentative, had issues, had problems. That's the way it would work. So the IRS carries its burden by using the sample, according to chief counsel advice, and then it's up to the taxpayer to go back and do something else. Now, I'm sure many of you remember your statistical sampling discussion. Some of us probably, it was that thing that was discussed in auditing. We vaguely had some reference in a math course on it. And if you're in tax, you probably then quickly forgot about it. But that's still going to be valid in this case. There's obviously going to be cases where it won't be possible to go through and audit in detail every bribe. But because of the way the tax return works, they're going to have to decide on all of these transactions. So in any event, that is the service's position if they have this issue. Next up. Okay, well, some of your clients who turned 70 and a half in 2020 are going to be getting erroneous notices and telling them they have to take minimum distributions in 2020 or for 2020. And the IRS has told us now that, yeah, we understand that. And that's going to be okay. Let's talk about this notice 2020-6 issued here on January the 24th. The SECURE Act, as you may remember, that we discussed here a few weeks ago, changed who needs to take a 2020 required minimum distribution. So if you have a 2020 required minimum distribution, the rule is going to be changed because previously, if you turned age 70 and a half in 2020, you had to take a distribution for 2020. Yes, you would have had until April of 2021, but there was going to be a 2020 required distribution. The SECURE Act changed that age to 72. So by definition, nobody will enter their first year for minimum distributions in 2020 because if they weren't 70.5 by the end of 19, and by the way, remember, if they were 70.5 by the end of 19, they still have to take their distributions. I don't care they're 71 this year. They had achieved 70.5 before the law changed, so we're still under the old rules for those people. Whether that's fair or not, long discussion, your clients can scream about it, that's fine, but whether or not it's fair, it's the way it works. So that's how we're working it. But your client who turns 70.5 this year, you know, they would normally, by the end of January, under the IRS rule, under the rules we have here, they would have to receive a notice by January 31st saying, hey, Mary, you will turn age 70.5 before the end of 2020. And because of that, Mary, you're going to be required to begin taking required minimum distributions. Your RMD for this year, you know, needs to be taken by April 1st of 2021. And they may very well provide her with a number and, you know, provide information about taking that distribution. The problem we're facing is that it was very, very late in the year when Congress finally passed this law. You know, it's signed into law with less than 10 days to go in 2019. And obviously that's less than 45 days before these notices have to go out. Our problem is the financial institutions who manage IRAs say, look, we have this stuff all ready to go. Our systems are set up to send these notices to people the year they turn 70.5. We don't have time to modify our software, test it, and, you know, do all we'd have to do to get these revised notices properly done by the end of January. So IRS, we need some relief. So what the IRS decided was, and remember, everybody, once you're over 70.5, you're supposed to get this, and the 5498 has information on it. So what the IRS has said, it will be okay if you send out erroneous information. And one caveat, they may send that out on the account holder's copy of the 5498. It won't be the one they send to the IRS, but they could still use that form to give your client the number. And they said those erroneous numbers are fine. We're not going to penalize you for having sent out 1099s that were erroneous based on this number, as long as you send corrections by April the 15th of 2020. Okay, that's great, except obviously your client is going to get this letter saying, hey, Mary, you need to take $12,000 from your IRA by the end of the year. And, you know, we can help you with that. We can do distributions. We can set you up on monthly payments. She's going to get that wonderful notice telling her all that stuff, all of which is wrong. Right? Well, they will set her up on monthly payments. But obviously, there's going to be an issue here because Mary will have that. And if you do some quick math, you're going to figure out that, at least for probably early payments, if she made any in January, signed up for this, she's going to get some of these RMDs, and she won't necessarily get the notice telling her that they didn't have to be taken until after 60 days have passed. And she will, in fact, have been told when she got that distribution that these can't be rolled over. But under the law, technically, she has 60 days to put it back in because it's not really an RMD. But since she didn't know that, well, you understand how all this goes. So we have a problem. Well, a couple of things going on. So that's problem number one to think about. And we'll talk about, IRS does have to discuss that problem here later. But they also raise another issue. The IRS is concerned that taxpayers who turn 70.5 in 2019 will have read about the SECURE Act and will think, I don't have to take that money out by April because I'm not 72 yet. And since I'm not 72, they got rid of my required distribution. The IRS is asking the institutions as well, this is kind of funny, so they want them to get the fixed information out, but not the other. They want these people probably at the same time, I'm going to bet, they send out these corrected notices for 2020, but they're asking, they actually don't require this, but they're suggesting that financial institutions should send some sort of notice to their clients who reached age 70.5 before the end of last year, not yet 72, that they still must continue to take their distributions despite not being 72 yet. That they have to continue doing that because the IRS is concerned, properly I think, that a lot of people aren't going to understand that distinction. They're going to say, wait, I'm not 72. I don't have to take the distribution. Yes, you do, if you were 70.5 by the end of last year. Finally, the notice concludes with a discussion that the IRS is considering what they should do if people take what they think were required minimum distributions, because that's what they were told, and then later they discover they didn't have to. Now, the sad part is right now we don't know what the IRS is going to do. My guess is they will offer some sort of late rollover relief. The real question is going to be how long into the year will people be allowed to take these required minimum distributions that aren't really required and still be able to come under this program. They've given us no details. To be totally honest, they haven't even committed to say they're going to let people put it back in if they're past the 60-day period, though that seems very likely. So you got to keep your eye on this. I would suggest, if you can easily do so, it would not be a bad idea to contact your taxpayers who are turning 70.5 in 2020 and tell your clients who are in that category that they are likely to get a notice from their bank saying they have to take a bank or broker, saying they have to take this distribution by the end of this year. Tell them, please call you, ignore that distribution or ignore that notice. We'll discuss what's really happening. Because tell them, you will get a correction by April 15th that will tell you to ignore that. But so don't start taking actions yet. Obviously, things are going to be a little messy here, and yes, we expect some things to go wrong. But in any event, sometime real soon now we'll have that fix, and so we'll just have to see how that works. In the interim, you're going to have a lot of taxpayers that have notices from their financial institutions that has advice telling them they have to do something that they don't have to do, and we're all okay with that for the moment. At least that's the official line. Now, interesting aside, Jonathan Curry wrote an article in Tax Notice Today Federal. It calls Coming Regs on the Estate Fees to Settle Excess Deductions Questions, issued on January the 24th, 2020. And what he was doing, he was covering a conference, the DC Bar Conference on January the 23rd, and speaking there was Catherine Hughes, Attorney Advisor of the Treasury Office of Tax Legislative Counsel. And the issue came up, people were asking her specifically at this, about a problem we have had since the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was passed. What happens is, you may remember that we lost the ability to deduct 2% of those things were miscellaneous deductions subject to 2% of AJ limitations. Now, the code actually simply calls those miscellaneous deductions. I realize you have that thing on Schedule A that called other miscellaneous that weren't subject to 2%, but those actually, per the code, aren't miscellaneous deductions. Those are just deductions that we didn't have any line to put them on, so that's why the IRS called them other miscellaneous. They're miscellaneous in traditional English term of miscellaneous, but not miscellaneous in the legal or tax view of miscellaneous. And you wonder why tax law is confusing. Anyway, so we have that. But the problem is when you had a trust or an estate, right? Last year of a trust or an estate, lots of times in the last year, especially of an estate, there may be very little income, right? But you incur a bunch of administrative fees that last year, legal fees, closing up the estate, other expenses. So you have deductions that are greater than the estate's income in the final year. Also happens if you close out a trust. So in that final year, you're allowed to pass out, if you cannot use those deductions against trust income, those excess deductions on termination are passed out to the beneficiaries of the estate, those who receive the estate corpus, or trust corpus, I should say. And that's under Section 642H2 of the code. But here's our problem right now. Regulation 1.642H2A indicates, and it always has, that these payments are considered to be not used in computing adjusted gross income, and because they're not in the list of items that aren't considered miscellaneous itemized deductions, and that list is found in Section 67B of the Internal Revenue Code, there's a list of which things are not. That's how you know what's not there. All deductions that don't go into computing adjusted gross income for an individual or a trust that are not listed in Section 67 as being not miscellaneous deductions are considered to be miscellaneous itemized deductions. It's a definition by exclusion. So since these are by regulation, we told what 642 means is they don't go into computing AGI. And since they're not in 67 as a, this is not a limited deduction, therefore they are a limited deduction. And of course, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, Section 67G says, if they're a limited deduction, we don't get to take any of them. Now, notice 2018-11, which was issued, explained a couple of things. And this was issued back in July of 2018. And what happened back there was that the IRS said, look, some people had thought that trusts lose all of their deductions. They said, no. There's a special rule in Code Section 67 that tells us that if an expense is incurred because assets are in trust, like trustees' fees, like the accounting fees for the accounting, like the fees to do the tax return for the 1041, that those are allowed in computing the trust adjusted gross income, and we're back to the same rule. Since they're allowed in computing adjusted gross income, they're not itemized deductions, so Section 67 doesn't cause a problem not having them in the list. But the other issue was, so that means, think about this, every deduction that's allowed on the 1041 is not a 2% deduction. However, when we terminate the trust or estate, and we have these excess deductions under 642H2, all of these deductions are things that weren't 2%ers. But if we follow the reg literally, they are old 2%ers when they go to the individual return. As such, they would be barred for deduction entirely. And notice 2018-11 essentially said, we're kind of trying to figure out how to deal with this. You know, we don't know what to do about this. You know, is it really true that we shouldn't get that deduction? And in fact, what Ms. Hughes said, she said, you know, they got a lot of comments, and people are now suggesting that regulation is probably in error. That in fact, nothing in the code says it has to be miscellaneous deduction. That in fact, the trust that the individual should be able to deduct it in the same manner as the trust could. So those expenses should retain their nature coming out the individual. Now, of course, that's great, except that's not what the reg has said forever, and we've never suggested that the reg was an error. But now, you know, now like, well, this just doesn't seem right. Should it be fixed? So the comments, and Ms. Hughes said, interestingly enough, she said unanimously the comments they've received, you know, what they've been told by various parties, including by the AICPA's Trust and Estates Tax Resource Panel, is that, you know, no, you've got it wrong. You know, these should be allowed as they were allowed to the trust. Now, back in 2018-11, you know, the promise was we're going to be issuing regs to explain how to do this. And you know, that kind of goes back, and I mentioned in the article I wrote on this, I referenced back to the late Dr. Jerry Purnell, who did articles in Byte Magazine years ago, microcomputer revolution time. Those who remember the early days of the Apple I, Apple II, S100 bus computers, and all that neat stuff. And of course, most of you I have no idea what you just said there, but don't worry about it. But back in those early days, late 70s, early 80s, he would do an article on the industry. And he had a term when vendors love to say, oh, look at this brand new thing. We're going to be doing this. We got this brand new feature. It's going to be wonderful, great. Our computers will be wonderful. And, you know, they indicated, oh, yeah, we're almost ready to ship it. Well, in many cases, those almost ready to ship things, if they ship, didn't ship for like 18 months, 2 years, or they never actually shipped. So he'd refer to that as being real soon now. They were coming out real soon now, which was tongue-in-cheek saying, don't expect to see this anytime soon. Well, little did we know that these proposed regulations were in the real soon now category. Right, we hadn't seen them. Because what happens was you expect it. So you're waiting, right? You expect, well, they're going to tell us this, right? July they come out with this, they've got to tell us something. So you're saying, well, we should know something by the end of the year so I can do tax planning for 2018. End of the year comes, we still haven't heard about it. Well, I got to do this individual return. The trust terminated. We did know on the 1041 we passed out these things, but what do I do with them on the 1040? They've got to tell me, right? Well, April 17th, that was the due date last year, remember? April 17th, 2019 came and went, and still no word from the IRS. So now we go on and, okay, I'll put them on extension. October 15th comes and goes, still no answer. Now, Ms. Hughes said that they had hoped to have guidance out by the time the 1041 returns were due last year. Now, she didn't say if that was original due date or extended, but obviously it doesn't really matter. We missed them all. So now she says, well, we're just about ready to issue proposed regs. And you begin wondering if, by just about ready, are we still real soon now? Because her term was right around the corner was what they said. And yeah, it's kind of like a real soon now issue. You know, what does real soon now mean? But anyway, she says we're going to both incorporate the actual guidance in those 2018-11, right? And then we're also going to give you the answer on how to handle these supposed 2% items. She didn't tell us what the answer will be. Now, we probably can suppose that she wouldn't have said that there was unanimous comments were unanimous in telling them to change the reg if the agency is going to then come back out and say, yeah, you all said to do this, but we're not going to do it. I'm going to think that it would have been more prudent for her to just say, we are looking at that issue, we will solve it there, and just stay quiet. So I'm somewhat optimistic we will get to be able to deduct them, but we still don't know yet. And there really is still no authority that allows us to claim that deduction. The reg specifically says, effectively, you can't. So it's kind of difficult to go against that. Well, or to file an A275R saying, we kind of hope you're changing the reg retroactively, so that's how we're doing it. She did say that the guidance may require some taxpayers to amend the return, but that conceivably could be because you might have claimed them and you shouldn't. I think more likely it's going to be people that didn't claim that go back and amend. In any event, though, that guidance coming out real soon now. So there's another set of amended returns you'll be looking at for next year, for this year. Should be fun. Finally, we've got an interesting one here. This is a case involving Microsoft, United States versus Microsoft Corp. U.S. District Court for the Western District of Washington, case number 2:15CV00102. The decision was issued on January the 17th, 2020. What was happening here was Microsoft was facing a loss of significant tax benefits related to some operations they had in Puerto Rico. And they were thinking they're going to shut that down. This is a number of years ago. This is their 2004-2005 return. But KPMG said, wait, guys, we think we can rearrange this and do something and move some intellectual property around, have some cost-sharing arrangements that we could essentially recover a lot of that benefit. And so Microsoft said, okay, let's look into that, right? And so they involved KPMG. They also involved a law firm in this situation. Now, obviously, the IRS finds out about this. IRS is examining them now for those years on this particular set of transactions. The question became a set of documents that the IRS asserted were covered by three privileges. Either the work product privilege, attorney-client privilege, or the federally authorized tax practitioner privilege. Now, I'm not going to spend time really on attorney-client privilege because for most of those here listening to the session, you're not attorneys, right? So that's not your issue. But work product and federally authorized tax practitioner privilege could cover most of the people listening here if you are either a CPA or an EA. Again, if you're an attorney, we've still got attorney-client to play with too, so we've got number three there. But if you're an EA or a CPA, we have the first two because a federally authorized tax practitioner basically is somebody who is authorized to practice before the IRS under Circular 230, right? And we know the categories, that's CPAs, EAs, and attorneys. So the question becomes, was there privilege in this case? Okay, well, let's talk first about this concept of work product privilege. Generally, if a non-attorney is involved in the preparation of documents in anticipation of litigation, and we clear for certain other hurdles, but that anticipation of litigation issue would be the big one here, then that can be covered by what's called work product privilege because it's meant to be supporting documents for the litigation that is going to occur, and it's considered unfair to let the other side, like, look at all your notes, now you analyze things and came to some conclusions, and yeah, that's not fair to do that when you're prepping. You don't get a look at the other side's prep you don't get a look at the other side's prep for the case. That's the idea coming here. Well, in this case, Microsoft claimed that a lot of these documents were prepared because they knew the IRS was very much into this thing. You know, they really didn't like these cases. And they said, well, we were ready that in fact, you know, we expected there'd be litigation. And these documents prepared by KPMG related to that sort of work product privilege. The court said, we're not quite so sure. One of the interesting aside is they said, look, here's the catch. These documents were not paid in anticipation of litigation for something you'd already done. Rather, these documents were effectively what was going to create the litigation. They were telling you how to implement a strategy that you then expected would get you into court. They're saying that's kind of putting the cart before the horse. You know, these were not, it's not as if you had already started these operations in Puerto Rico, had set up a program, and now suddenly, oh man, the IRS is going to take a look at this and then brought somebody in. No, these people came in to design the program. As such, that's not work product. They said, secondly, it's weird. You tell us this is work product privilege. It was necessary for your litigation. But there's no evidence the law firm you were working with ever requested this work be done. And secondly, amazingly, a bunch of these documents turned out, when the IRS tried to ask for them, it determined that you can't find some of these documents that were these important privileged documents that you needed for litigation. It's like if they were so important documents that were going to be used in litigation, you ought to cap them. So the court said, we don't buy on the ones you're claiming work product privilege for the most part. We're not buying that story. So they said, nope, you're going to lose on that. How about the federally authorized tax practitioner privilege? Well, the court admits this is a complex area. This is under Section 7525 of the code. And the way this works, the way 7525 works, is a CPA or EA has the same, who is doing tax advisory work, tax-related work, has the same privilege an attorney would have if they were doing the same work. Now, attorneys who are listening in are, you know, probably be very aware, the attorney-client privilege is not absolute. There are lots of ways an attorney, what attorney does doesn't always get the privilege for the client. For instance, if the attorney is merely giving business advice, that doesn't get covered. If the attorney is preparing a document for disclosure, you know, if it's going to be disclosed, that kills it. That's also, by the way, why a tax, if you're preparing a tax return, that virtually never qualifies for privilege because that's been litigated with attorneys multiple times and it gets nailed. That's not considered legal work in this sense because you're preparing a return to give to the IRS. That is a document to be disclosed. Work related to that is considered to be generally not privileged work. So we get into lots of messes of how that goes. So we got this whole complication of legal privilege. But there's a second issue involved in today's, in this area, which is this does not apply, this special rule does not apply to non-attorneys, right? Remember, attorneys have attorney-client privilege. So theoretically, it also, you know, 7525 will kick out attorneys in this case, but it doesn't matter because then you're back to attorney-client privilege. It does not apply if the federally authorized tax practitioner, the EA or CPA, is promoting a tax shelter. And the issue became here that the court found, again, KPMG was involved in designing the implementation of this program. The court decided that, so the question becomes, and the court agrees, merely reducing your tax is not a tax shelter. The tax shelter definition we work from here is under 6662 D2CII, and that definition says is a partnership or other entity or any investment plan or arrangement or any other plan arrangement if a significant purpose of the partnership entity plan or arrangement is the avoidance or evasion of federal tax. Well, merely reducing your tax is not a problem. But the question became, is a significant purpose or the principal purpose of this transaction to reduce taxes, right? Essentially, to avoid or reduce taxes, or avoid or evade taxes. And we're not saying evasion here. We're going to talk about avoidance. Evasion is illegal. Avoidance is what you'd call tax planning. And they're saying, in this case, there was really no business reason to have what they're going to put in Puerto Rico be there, or to claim that these payments were being made, except because it was really causing other problems for Microsoft to operate the business. But there was this huge tax benefit if they did it. So they said, look, realistically, with this transaction, it was clearly a significant purpose, if not the principal purpose, of this transaction was to get back that lost tax money and, in fact, save even more. Said because of that, this is a tax shelter promotion. It's very fact dependent, but it was a tax shelter promotion because there really was very, very little other business reason to do it aside from getting the tax break you were looking for. As such, KPMG was involved in the promotion of a shelter, so as such, the 75-25 privilege will not apply to the documents that they were attempting to argue it should apply to the extent they were involved in promotion of tax shelter, which, as I remember, the numbers here is like the vast majority of documents, like huge percentage, are all being cleared under this particular challenge. This case has been bouncing around for a while, but it is interesting to study what does this tax preparer privilege actually cover, what doesn't it. Reality is that probably it doesn't cover as much as people think it does, just as a attorney-client privilege does not cover as much as the average person may think it covers. So be careful with regard to this whole 75-25 issue, but also be aware there are cases where it does work, but then you've got to take steps to make sure that you continue to protect the privilege, because all the rules that apply to attorney-client privilege in terms of making sure it's not disclosed to unauthorized parties will apply in this case. We're getting very close to the end of the 2019-2020 CP season. You can start planning for the 2020-2021 season. Your state societies will begin accumulating their catalogs here over the next few months. They'll get their catalog stuff posted normally on the web. Also, a lot of them will send out print catalogs once tax season ends. Keep an eye on that. I've already got dates booked with various state societies for next year, so I'll be out and about doing things. And by the way, if you want us to do a in-house session next year, this is also the time to call us for that, because to be totally honest, days fill up. And if you call us in late October, trying to book us in November or December, we're probably telling you we might be able to see you in late January or February. So if you want to do that, we do that for firms. Obviously, you need to have a large enough group to make sense to bring somebody in. But if you have a group, probably 15 to 20, it makes it really easy. We can make the numbers work, probably. You can go ahead and we can talk about doing that. But if you want us, if you want me on the calendar for next year, you probably better get it signed up. We've already got firms that have signed up. Now, I guess that's how I'll phrase it for next year. So get in line, get going. Also, I still have one more live course coming up this year. This Thursday, January the 30th, I'll have an 8-hour session for real estate partnerships. Get in, get out, get taxed. That'll be the Arizona Society of CPAs. That one will be taped for rebroadcast by Cal CPA later, but it'll be live and webinar this week, so you can take it that way. So we'll be doing that course. Once I do that, I'm done with CPE until after we start the new season in May. I'm done with CPE that is going to be live CPE available to the public. I still have a couple of firms to work with before I start my pure tax season, and we'll still have some of these rebroadcasts. This has been the Current File Tax Development. You can be sure to join us every week on this broadcast. You can get our regular updates online, currentfiletaxdevelopments.com. We post there as things happen. We also have questions and comments you can send to edzollers@currentfiletaxdevelopments.com. You can follow me on Twitter. I'll be on @edzollers. I also follow discussions on the subreddit of /r/taxpros. I also take a look at Cal CPA's Tax Talk site. You know, their listserv that they maintain, which is open to any CPA in the country. And again, if you want to get involved in that, you can email me and I'll get you hooked up with the proper people who run that. It's a little more involved to get in, but it's worth getting in. Also, you can follow me, or I should say, I also check in on the Connect sites run by three state societies, Arizona, Minnesota, and New Jersey. I'll take a look at things that are posted there. And if I think I can be helpful in making a comment, I'll try to do that there. So if you're a member of one of those societies, you can check in there. Otherwise, the week starting, and I forgot to say one thing we found out this week. Those 163J regulations, you know, for business interest that we're all waiting on, we're going to be waiting some more. Because now OIRA has a meeting booked on February the 4th with an interested party. So to be totally honest, at this point, I am thinking we're going to be lucky if we see those regs in March. Because also this week reported in tax notes, we had a report that the IRS at that same DC Bar conference, it was reported that they were hoping to issue those final regs along with some new proposed regs in 163J on topics I haven't covered before. That means you got to wait for both of those to clear OIRA. So, yeah, if you're waiting to get started on 163J calculations for regs to be given to you, I'd start working on those calculations. Okay. Otherwise, though, we will see you next week here on Current Federal Tax Developments.